Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Splendid.
I am so happy to be talking about movies and games with friends.
As always, thanks to everyone who was listening on Tuesday. There was this weird thing that happened last week in the Substack architecture on the website that made it look like Across the Movie Aisle was my personal Substack. It said, like, Sonny Bunch is rising in movies. And I was like, this is wrong. Can somebody at Substack fix this? Because this is a three-person show. It's a three-man show. There's three people's labor here. I would never argue for the labor theory of value. The show is either worth it to you or it isn't, regardless of the tremendous number of hours that it takes to keep this thing going every week. But just know that your small contribution help keeps it viable, because it really is kind of a lot of work for a part-time gig. Anyway, I know we make it look easy because we're very good at this. We're very good at this, but there's lots to do. And I hope you sign up for a paying membership, because then you can comment and, you know, take part in the chat, which is great. And we're very close to hitting that first year sustainability goal a few months early, which is very exciting. So go sign up and become a part of the community. It's great. All right. Now on to our opening segment, controversies and non-controversies. All right. We got a silly one today. We got a silly one. I love it. It's silly. The New York Times announced that Wordle, the game that you play on your phone while you're going to the bathroom, where you try to guess a five-letter word, is going to be a TV show hosted by Savannah Guthrie and Jimmy Fallon on NBC. It's going to be a TV game show on NBC. How about that? On the one hand, again, this is very silly. It's Wordle. It's the easiest game on earth. I currently have a 279-day streak going, and that's only because I forgot to play one evening, 279 days ago. On the other, though, you can imagine how it could be turned into a competitive thing, right? You got teams and time limits and the such. I don't know. Make them do it on hard mode, I say. That'll trip them all up. That said, there are a couple of interesting things here, broader media stories here. One is that the New York Times is reinforcing the fact that it is functionally a gaming company with a news appendage attached to it. In the fourth quarter of 2024, the Times reported that it had 1.93 million subscribers to the news-only digital product, while 3.45 million people subscribed to other single-product services. Now, that includes recipes, and games and The Athletic and audio. But I'll just say from experience that the reason I moved from a news-only sub to a bundled sub, it's a group that accounts for another 5.44 million subscriptions on the site, is because I wanted full access to the suite of games that the Times offered. I want Wordle, I want Connections, I want Spelling Bee, I want the crossword, I want it all. And I play them all. I'm getting pretty good at them, too. I'm crushing this crossword thing, guys. People kind of scoffed when the Times paid in the low seven figures for Wordle back in 2022. But it was a great investment tied to a growing market segment for the paper. And this is really nothing new, right? It used to be that the funny pages and the movie listings subsidized the investigative reporting. The sports box score was what you would actually subscribe for, and that would pay for the local town hall coverage, et cetera. What's passed as prologue and all that. Another angle here is that the longevity of game shows in the world of TV is something to kind of marvel at. And again, this kind of makes sense, right? Game shows are cheap to produce, and stories about audiences love them. Audiences love them. One of my favorite stories from the Eisner era of Disney was when Who Wants to Be a Millionaire came out. Huge success. Disney promptly smothered it by moving it from an occasional special event to a nightly show. But even after it stopped being a primetime draw, the show went on until 2021. It was on for like 20 years. It was crazy. 25 years. Some insane amount of time. These things are wildly popular. I guess whenever I go to the gym, I see a face I recognize, Joel McHale or Rob Lowe or somebody like that, hosting some sort of game on primetime network TV. I see ads for it. I don't watch any of them. I don't get it, really. It's not my thing. I don't even really like watching Jeopardy. But enough people seem to enjoy them, and they're very cheap to produce. So I guess it makes sense. I want to ask a very important question, though, before we get to the meat of this. I need to know, Peter, what your starting Wordle word is.
I don't have a starting Wordle word because I've never played Wordle.
You sick man.
I'm fine. I have an Xbox Game Pass subscription. I've got the Ultimate, which they just reduced the cost because people were mad about the previous cost increase, price increase.
I don't know what it means.
It gets you a lot of free games, and you can play Call of Duty against the teenagers who will absolutely murder you.
And you don't have to
come up with a word except for a four-letter one that you scream every time you get murdered by a 13-year-old.
Do you use the headset? Do you talk into the headset while you're playing?
No, I have a nine-channel surround sound system that sounds amazing when you're playing Call of Duty.
Well, yeah, but don't you need a mic to speak into, or does it just pick up?
No, I don't. In fact, one thing I do is when I log into these games, I immediately turn off all voice chat options. I can't hear anyone, and I also can't speak to anyone. I don't want to talk to anyone. Right. I just want to kill other people.
Fair.
Games in the news.
What do we think of this? What's the deal here?
It's really interesting as a business strategy, right? And like your sort of quick breakdown there of the New York Times subscription revenue is just a reminder that journalism, the actual news part of journalism, the writing part of journalism, has always been and still is quite difficult to fund just on its own. And back in the days of, local newspaper monopolies, when the LA Times had something in the range of a 30%, operating profit every year and was the most profitable media organization or something like that, that the world had ever known. This is around 1990 or so. Many of those newspapers were still not primarily funded. But like the thing that drove the subscriptions and also like the readership and then the ads, right, and all of this was not the front page news. It wasn't the reporting. It wasn't all of the kind of socially valuable stuff. It was people wanted to know the box scores. There was a huge amount of revenue associated with the classified ads. People loved the crossword puzzles, still do, actually, right? And there was, in fact, just related to this, I believe I saw something, maybe you guys know about this, that for the first time ever, the New York Times crossword puzzle had a mistake in it, and it was unsolvable. And this happened within the last couple of weeks. And I believe that was only in the print edition, not the online edition. Right? Which you can't, because you can't correct the print edition after it has gone out to all of the subscribers. One reason why the digital world, there are advantages to it. Like, I like print a lot for a lot of things, but sometimes digital is better. But this is a reminder that, yes, we all love news. We all love writing. We've all worked for magazines and newspapers here. But these things are very difficult to fund. And you have to find, essentially, historically, you have to find some sort of big bundle, a lot of which is not actually news. It's not actually the thing that is produced by the journalists who have bylines. It's something else that funds all those journalists.
Yeah, Alyssa, the TV game portion of this is kind of interesting because it's totally invisible. It's one of these dark matter of broadcast network TV, but they are everywhere and they are constantly out there and people seem to love them.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is that they are family entertainment to a certain extent. I did not watch a lot of television growing up, but I have these lovely memories of curling up with my grandfather in his recliner to watch Jeopardy, right? It was, game shows are often on at an hour where the entire family can watch. They are often appropriate for everyone. They are at least like mildly educational in some cases. And they develop their own storylines. Like my friend and former Washington Post colleague, Drew Goins, had a really fun run on Jeopardy year before last. And it is, I mean, you have more competitive, you have, sort of reality TV competitions like Survivor that are higher stakes, that have sort of villain edits. But game shows, traditional game shows, are in a lot of ways sort of our last mass wholesome entertainment. And that's fun.
Can
I
ask you a quick question about that? Are they really a mass entertainment at this point? What are the ratings on these things and how do they compare to, I don't know, the CSI type shows, the kind of formulaic dramas that continue to do some of the best ratings, at least for scripted shows, on television?
That is a good question. It does quite well in syndication. I think it is still up there with, 7 or 8 million viewers per episode. Same with Wheel of Fortune. So it's still doing fairly well. I mean, especially if you compare something like Jeopardy to, where network comedies appear to be clocking in these days. Like that's pretty healthy numbers. It's not a Dick Wolf Chicagoverse, but they're also often on earlier. They're not necessarily like quite prime time.
They're
it's
cheap.
Not quite.
Yeah.
And
doesn't that strike you? Doesn't that strike you then as an opportunity for disruption through YouTube? I mean, to some degree, the audience is older and stuck in the cable, the cable mode. But over time here, and maybe over time, I mean, like now, doesn't this strike, like, that's the sort of thing. YouTube has a lot of kind of inexpensive talk showy type things. This is not exactly the same thing, but it's in the same mold, the cheapness of it, right? The fact that you just don't need a gigantic audience, but that it appeals to a fairly wide group of people. It's pretty basic in a lot of cases. I mean, I mean that not as a as an insult, just like these things are not, they're not complicated to pick up. They're designed to be kind of simple pleasures that you can watch for a half an hour and get it without having to, without having to be like a deep fan.
Yeah, totally reasonable. Maybe a thing that could be done. I think the, sort of discoverability, it's the same challenge as anything else. But I also think that part of what anchors game shows is the sort of ritual of them, right? I mean, it is, you're turning on at 6 or 7 or whatever to watch Jeopardy, to watch Wheel of Fortune. I think that actually, I do not know that you would build the same audience for these shows with asynchronous viewing, especially something like Jeopardy, where people like to see people come back sort of week after week. You've seen, a number of my friends who have been on Jeopardy have arranged like live watch parties for their friends that have been really successful. I think that they have, especially the ones where contestants can continue from episode to episode, have a nice, sort of narrative quality to them that actually I think is part of what makes them appealing.
Do you guys think of something like Squid Game as a game show?
The Netflix drama?
It's not the one that started out as an actual game. Where people actually. It's not a scripted drama. There's an actual, just sort of my understanding, maybe I'm totally crazy. There is an actual kind of game, right? Or Flora's Lava, maybe? Is maybe what I'm thinking of?
They did after Squid Game came out, they did a like Squid Game competition. Yeah.
Right, but it's a competition show. It's a little like
a reality show. It's more like that Wipeout show.
American Ninja Warrior, whatever this, those kind of physical competition shows that are elaborate and a little bit like Olympics meets Double Dare.
Yeah, I guess maybe there are sort of multiple tranches of game shows. When I think about a game show, though, I think about something that, there's not like physical danger or risk. It is literally sort of a, it's a televised version of either sort of a playground or like a mental game. I think of it as being sort of closer in relationship to board games and card games than to.
I think of something on a set with a host. There's a set and there's a host and there's like you're answering questions or you're rolling. Like my favorite version of this has always been. The fact that when I had a sick day and I was in middle school or elementary school on USA Network in the middle of the day, there would be reruns of Pressure Luck or Scattergories or whatever. And you would just watch those or, you'd watch The Price is Right or whatever. But you could just watch like literally 15-year-old
network game shows, and they were just as good as the day they came out because, like, they're pretty timeless. You get the whammy or you don't.
But it's also just like it's the TV equivalent of like a cup of chicken soup, right? Like it's comforting. You know, maybe it has some immune effects that make you get better faster when you're sick.
That's very RFK coded right there.
Some of us drink Jameson when we're sick.
Stay home and eat soup and watch the video games. You'll be fine.
Don't take medicine.
I won't. I have no idea.
I won't. He's an idiot.
I think
better
this is
or
like,
worse than 2 ounces of Jameson is my question because
I think this is just a really savvy move for both the Times and NBC, right? Like it's a brilliant branding move for the Times. You know, I think Savannah Guthrie has always been beloved, but especially given the personal tragedy her family has endured recently, she is sort of adored and people have sort of concern for an attachment to her that's unusually high right now. And I don't know whether they'll be able to find enough variation beyond like having people have five guesses to get a word to make it interesting, I think remains to be seen. Game structure is actually really hard. But I think it's a really smart move for both parties. You know, maybe the game show.
Alyssa, what is your starting word on Wordle? You must have a starting word. You have to play Wordle, right?
I play Wordle like cyclically. Also, my husband and I share a Times account, so sometimes he beats me to it. And I'm actually more of a New Yorker crossword puzzles gal. So this is going to be the segment
totally
that most expresses all of our personalities. But my opening Wordle word is actually adieu because I like getting all of the vowels out of the way.
So many vowels. That's a good one. You get all the vowels out there except for O. It's great.
Yep. That is my opening Wordle play.
Mine is least, and it's a good word, let me tell you. One knocks out a bunch. It's a high-quality word.
Why does it... I don't explain the word.
I'm not going to explain Wordle strategy
don't
to you,
okay,
Peter
the,
Suderman.
The
you are,
that,
you are no, not... No. You're not... Well,
I was going to ask, but I don't care. And it would... our listeners don't care. The thing that I want to know from the two of you is what do you guys think makes a good game show host? Because I feel like I have some sense of what makes a good podcast host or TV news anchor or things like that. But people really become attached to game show hosts. And game show hosts don't have the opportunity to do things like share their own opinion on very much. I mean, there's a little tiny bit here and there, but they are mostly just, I mean, they are in some sense umpires, right? Who are just sort of moving the game along and explaining the rules where necessary. You know, sort of judging this answer is correct or not. There's a kind of warmth or lack thereof. There's, you know, like I understand there's some qualities that go beyond that, but it's really hard for me to think of what would make a great game show. Like how would I describe that? What would those qualities be?
I think it depends on the game.
Yeah, it does. It really does. Right. And it also depends on the vibe you want for the show, right? Do you want it to be like more erudite, like a Jeopardy or something like that? Or do you want it to be more more cozy and welcoming, like a Wheel of Fortune? Or is it like you want a quippy, you know, somebody delivering one-liners? Like it just depends on the show. I think it also depends on what happens to the players. If you have people who are getting eliminated, right? Like you want like a quippier, like nastier host, not necessarily like, nasty, but
like Donald Trump. You're
like
fired.
Trump
exactly.
Likes,
game
likes
show
Simon
host
Cowell.
President.
Yep.
Exactly. Yep. Precisely.
But I think like, again, Sorry. It's sort of what are you inviting the audience into, right? Or if you're inviting them into a spectacle where people get tortured a little bit, then you want someone who the audience is sort of reflexively going to agree with and look up to. If you want the audience to play along, someone who makes them feel smart. Like I think Alex Trebek always did a really good job of being warm, but sort of high level, right? Like he made you feel like you were in sort of a contest of wits along with him and the audience, you know? Regis is like, you know, Regis Philbin is like really good carnival barker, right? Like he's showing everybody a good time. There's lights, there's flashing, like, and he's welcoming you in, but like you're not sort of participating in the same, like you're not in sort of a cozy like faculty club together. It just all depends on the game and it all depends on the vibe.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that NBC is going to be doing a Wordle game on TV? Alyssa.
It's a controversy that the Washington Post never bought Wordle. God, so many things went wrong there. But no, this is a controversy, a great idea for everyone involved.
Peter.
When something works and people like it, you should make more of it. So it's a non-controversy.
It's definitely a non-controversy, so long as we're allowed. We should be allowed to play along at home in real time. They should do these live. They should be live, and the people should be allowed to play at home so you can prove that you're better than that idiot on the TV box in front of you.
Second screen experience. That's right. This is it. That's actually kind of genius, Sonny. And this is...
Of course it's genius.
This is, yeah, I know, because it's your idea, right? But no, this is a thing that's obvious, and it hadn't even occurred to me, again, as a non-Wordle player, is this sort of programming is ideally suited to people half paying attention while also looking at their phones, especially if you specifically give them something to do on their phones.
On the New York Times app, where you want people to be anyway, because you want to get them to be used to consuming it.
Exactly. All right.
Synergy.
Love it. So many chances for synergy. All right. Make sure to get over here on Thursday for a bonus episode on Mortal Kombat and Moral Panics and the new movie Mortal Kombat, which is terrible, but seems to be getting a pass from critics. Anyway, we're going to be talking about Mortal Kombat, Moral Panics. It's going to be fun. And right now on this show, we're going to be doing a far more pleasant main event. The Sheep Detectives. The movie stars Hugh Jackman as George Hardy, a shepherd who loves his wards. He names each of them. He gives them all funny little names, and he reads murder mysteries to them every night before bedtime. And then he himself is murdered one night. And the sheep, who are voiced by, among others, Patrick Stewart, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Regina Hill, Brett Goldstein, Chris O'Dowd, Bryan Cranston, just a cavalcade of A-listers. They must come together to figure out who done it. They'd better figure it out because the town in which they reside has an idiot police officer, Tim Darries, played by Nicholas Braun. And there's a whole flock of suspects, including the neighboring farmer, Caleb, the scheming butcher, Ham, the local innkeeper, Beth, a mysterious newcomer claiming to be George's daughter, played by Molly Gordon. There's George's attorney, who's played by Emma Thompson. She reveals that he was secretly worth tens of millions of pounds. And now everyone's a suspect, even the good old Reverend Hillcote. Officer Derry and an ambitious newsman, Elliot, will only be able to solve the case if the sheep pitch in. Because again, Derry's an idiot. He's just a real dummy. What a moron. He's dumber than a sheep. Can you believe it? Anyway, here's the thing. There's no reason whatsoever this film should work. And indeed, it was kind of fun, like sitting in theaters with paying audiences, watching them watch this trailer, because I saw it about 1,000 times. And every time it came on, I was just paying a little bit of attention, because I swear to God, everyone was like insulted by this thing when they would first see it on the screen. They'd be like, why are these sheep talking and trying to solve a crime? I don't like it. And then as the trailer would go along, they'd kind of like warm up to it, and then they'd get into it. And I would say the audience I saw the actual film with was very into it. And that makes sense, because this movie is simply delightful. It is fun for ages 9 to 99. It has some darker moments with a few scary scenes that if you have very young children, you might want to, you know, think about not taking them to. I don't know. They'd probably be fine. But it's usually very moving. It's got a nice little message about not bullying children who were born at the wrong time of year. And it's all wrapped up in a neat little murder mystery. And it's surprisingly funny. It's got a decent combination of wordplay and physical comedy, as one might expect from a veteran of the Minions and Despicable Me series, as director Kyle Balda is. And that really is like the secret sauce here. This plays like a live action cartoon in certain sequences. And it makes sense that a guy like this would be the director of it. I'm not saying this is a perfect movie. Nicholas Braun and Nicholas Galitzin, who plays the writer who shows up in town, they're both very broad
here. Like, they're almost in a slightly different, more kid-centric film. They really should just sit down and watch this movie and look at what Emma Thompson is doing, because she perfectly balances, like, the material is very arch, but she has these very punchy line deliveries, and she doesn't tolerate foolishness. She does a very good job with the material. It's a little bit preachy. Let's be honest. If this movie had been made by Angel Studios, I think folks would be hooting more about the fairly explicitly Christian nature of the thing. All the talks about flocks and shepherds and the meek inheriting the earth and all that stuff. But it's sotto voce enough that it goes unnoticed. It has gone unnoticed by most, I think. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. I don't know. Maybe it's just the shepherds and flocks that threw me off. I don't know. There's a whole genre of talking animal movies, and most of them are garbage. But there is a subgenre of talking animal movies that gets a pass from critics because they are very delightful and very, very well done. The Paddington and Babe films are key texts here. And I think this falls into that latter subgenre, right? Yes, this is a family movie, but it's one that works for all the family rather than just the kids. Alyssa, aren't you disappointed that we did this instead of Mortal Kombat 2? Didn't this movie need way more fatalities?
I remain quite upset about this, but, you know, I do a lot of things for you guys. This may be the thing that was too far. No, the Talking She movie was adorable. My favorite critical response to it has been Jill Lepore writing in The New Yorker that the movie doesn't understand enough about either murder or sheep, which she apparently knows because she keeps sheep. But I think part of what works about this movie is that...
Come on.
I know.
How does she know about murder?
Good question. Really fascinating.
She really seems to be putting herself out there.
Yes. The Sheep Detectives doesn't know enough about sheep or murder t-shirt is raising a lot of questions. I think there are a couple of things that make this movie work. The one is that George himself is not sort of a totally charming human being, right? He likes sheep, but he clearly does not like people very much. He turns out to have done something like actually pretty not good earlier in his life. He is clearly difficult to get along with. He's a judgmental vegetarian, which, like,
those people are the worst.
There is a very funny line, which Ham is like, I can understand why a woman would be a vegetarian, but like a man, God, like what is wrong with him? But he's vindictive, he's judgy, he does not get along with people, like he gets along very well with his sheep. And so he has been good to animals, but not to people. And I think that is that little sour note about his relationship with people keeps the film from being just way too cloying. I also think that it sort of hits the same note that Pixar did in Up with the talking dogs there, who, you know, are this sort of like, they are this distillation of sort of dog thought in human voices, and the disconnect is very funny. And so the movie is not afraid of the fact that like sheep have a sort of reputation in the animal kingdom for being like cowardly and not terribly bright. The really wonderful children's book authors, Alison Martin Provinson, have a whole series of books about their farm, Maple Hill Farm, in which there's one smart sheep and the rest of them are all just like unbelievable ninnies and cowards. I enjoyed that aspect of the movie. I also just think like it's a good movie about dealing with grief and kids, right? Because, I mean, there is this sort of funny little subplot in the movie where the sheep can choose to forget things that upset them. But there's one sheep who can't forget. And, you know, an arc of the movie is the smartest sheep, Lily, learning to both to, you know, sort of solve George's murder, but also to confront an uncomfortable feeling and just sort of sit with it. And this is a hard thing for kids to do, especially young kids, right? You know, my son got very upset over the weekend about the fact that like my grandparents aren't alive anymore, right? And it's not like one of my grandparents died proximately, you know, they all have been dead for quite some time. But he just got so sad about the idea that like I didn't have grandparents, right? And so learning to just sort of accept information that is sad, the knowledge that the world is imperfect, And to recognize the value of that kind of hurt. I mean, there's this wonderful line, it's probably from some cheesy ass movie. It's, you know, what is grief but love persisting, right? And Lily is sort of learning that forgetting George and not having the uncomfortable feelings occasioned by his death and the knowledge of the nature of his death would actually be worse than never having loved him or known him at all. And the movie handles that in ways that are, like, in one scene, quite theologically funny, like watching a bunch of sheep trying to make sense of what God is. It's like kind of great. And Sunny, you know, you mentioned that you thought this movie would have caught a lot of flack if it was made by Angel Studios. You know, I'm not Christian, but actually really enjoy having a movie where religion, people who are religious, the clergy, like, play a role in people's lives, right? That's a weird sort of excision from the fabric of society that many movies perform. And I actually think that, you know, religion and religious figures are often a framework for having moral discussions that movies aren't very good at conducting otherwise. And so I was really glad to see that here, much in the same way that I enjoyed the latest Knives Out, that I'm looking forward to the sort of theological implications of Disclosure Day later this summer. So yeah, like, maybe, you know, I may not be a full, like, Angel Studios partisan or anything, but the religiosity of this movie did not bother me. In fact, I think kind of enhanced my enjoyment of it.
Yeah, I didn't mean that as a criticism precisely, but it's interestingly there for sure. For the record, the quote is, "What is grief if not love persevering?" which is from WandaVision, which is a WandaVision quote, Alyssa. Oh. And that was a line that was uttered to justify the enslavement and torture of an entire town of people. So I'm glad you that has stuck with you. I hate that show for that precise reason. But the movie itself, you did not take your kids to it, right?
No, my daughter was actually sort of disappointed that she couldn't go, which is like a first in the history of our family. I was going to ask,
do you think you would take your kids to see it?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I would have taken my 7-year-old, my almost 8-year-old, but probably not my 4-year-old to see it.
Well, yeah, I think that's fair. Peter, what did you make of The Sheep Detectives?
Well, I thought it was interesting that Alyssa singled out George Hardy, the Hugh Jackman character, the Shepherd character, as being a little bit sour, because I hadn't noticed that. I think you're totally right. But I was just like, oh, here's a guy who doesn't really want to be around people. He sits like alone with his bottle of whiskey reading detective novels while enjoying the view with his large animals who he relates to. Like, that just seems very normal to me. Like, that's my life, right? And the way that they've made the sheep in this movie a little bit dog-like and a little bit large dog-like in the way that they nuzzle up to each other and kind of interact with each other, it's very good. And this is something, the thing that I wanted to point out that Alyssa didn't talk about quite as much is how good the performances are by the animated sheep. And I don't just mean the voice acting, though the voice acting is universally excellent here. These sheep do a really impressive thing that you take for granted as you're watching it, which is they exist in a kind of uncanny valley, except it's a canny valley, because you can see that they are animated, right? They don't look quite precisely real. They're talking, they're stacking on top of each other. They're doing sort of cartoon comic book things, you know, or cartoonish actions and behaviors that don't, you know, sort of that don't read as real, that read as being like in an animated movie. And yet they also manage to interact with human beings and natural settings in a way that looks relatively realistic. And the whole thing just kind of forms together coherently, visually, so that you've got human actors, sheep actors, sheep voice actors, and it all just works. I don't want to say that every shot is exactly perfect. I don't want to say that there's never a bit where you think, oh, the CG here, maybe you should have another pass on on this bit, especially in some of the more comic action beats in the middle of the movie. But the characters in this movie just feel natural and realistic isn't exactly right, but like they are all inhabiting the same world, which is a very, very difficult thing to do for human actors working with animated actors, right? Or animated characters. And especially when the animated characters are on the one hand supposed to look essentially to the humans as if they are photoreal, but then when the humans aren't around, you know, in a sort of Calvin and Hobbes-esque way, the animated sheep become more human-like, right? So they start smiling and sort of having, you know, facial expressions. And it's just the fact that I didn't even think about this at all until after I left the theater shows how seamless it is. And I don't think I've seen anybody else comment on this. We talk about bad CGI all the time on this podcast. It is a very common complaint over the past 15 years amongst movie critics is that this stuff looks like weightless garbage. Well, this doesn't look exactly precisely photoreal in every shot, but it looks right. And it just sells the characters and the story and the world and the interactions between the stuff that is virtual and the stuff that is real, physical human beings actually acting. Part of that's that the human actors are also quite good, right? I mean, I agree that Nicholas Braun is a little bit overbroad, but even there, I think he is on the same wavelength as the rest of the film, although he's just a little bit sillier, but he's also playing an idiot. And he's supposed to be playing, right? He is a comic idiot in a way.
What a moron.
that kind of justifies, especially in the context of this somewhat silly premise movie, that justifies the fact that he seems a little bit like a cartoon character himself. And the fact that he seems like a cartoon character helps the physical, the live action world blend in with the animated world here, right? Like they're sort of seamlessly sort of crossing the streams so that at times the sheep seem a little more human than the people do. And what that means is this movie can be very funny, right? It can be quite clever. But then when you get to some genuinely sad and emotional bits about three quarters of the way through this film, it really lands. And it, like, you realize you have somehow or another over the course of the first 75 minutes of this perfectly, nearly perfectly paced, not quite 2 hour, you know, little detective romp in the Agatha Christie style, that you have become attached to these animated sheep. And that, like, you feel something for them. And it's a strange experience because they're just animated sheep voiced by Bryan Cranston and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, right? And you're like, I fell for them somehow or another. And I was really quite taken with this movie. I also am a sucker, a total sucker for everything. If you want to tell a story, your first idea should be, like, you want to, I should say, not if you want to tell a story. If you want to tell a story about a setting, a place, or a group of characters, but you don't know where the story is, it should be a detective story. And maybe this is because the first novel that I ever really fell in love with was Isaac Asimov's Case of Steel, which is a 8 years old. And from there, that was it. It was over, guys. I was just like, science fiction, like genre, like science fiction for the rest of my life. I was already kind of a science fiction fan, but didn't realize it until the age of 8. And what that is, it is a science fiction detective novel. And it was literally Isaac Asimov. He was trying to prove that science fiction could be just as good a vehicle for storytelling as any other genre. And so he was like, I love Agatha Christie books. I'm going to make essentially an Agatha Christie murder mystery, but set in a future, you know, science fiction New York society. It's great. I love that book. I'd love to see it adapted. I'd love to adapt it. If there's a producer out there listening, it's just something that should be a movie. But that sort of thing, where you take an interesting setting, an interesting set of characters, and turn it into a detective novel. I just finished reading the newest Tana French novel. It's so good, guys. It's just like, that's the thing that gets me, especially when it is reasonably well executed. And this is reasonably well executed as a detective story, but then also as using that detective story, not just to sort of figure out who done it, but to investigate the town. Investigate the characters, show us what their emotional, moral, spiritual lives are like, And they are finding out, they're not just finding out who the killer was, though we do, and it's a satisfying explanation. They're finding out something about themselves and the meaning of life and the meaning of death. And this is actually the thing I was going to ask you. We already talked a little bit about your kids, but this movie struck me not just as a way of teaching kids about grief, but about the reality of death. And it is a movie that I think probably does a very good job of that, but it's much heavier than I thought it was going to be. And I won't say it's a super dark, this is not a grim, heavy movie, but this is a film that goes to, like, the sheep kind of have a little bit of a spoiler here. One thing we learn about the sheep pretty early on is that they have used their forgetting power to forget any kind of real deaths. And so they just think that sheep's that would become clouds someday. And the journey of the movie is them understanding that no, death is real, and that, like, people, other sheep, your friends, your great shepherd, played by Hugh Jackman, sometimes are pass away or are taken from you, and that this is a sort of sad and difficult and permanent fact of life. And the fact that this is, they're like, that's a lesson to be derived quite gently in certain ways, but also quite directly in other ways, from an animated sheep detective movie. Be still my heart. I loved it.
And I will say, like, you know, speaking as a parent, I think some kids will be like, this could be a useful way to introduce the concept of death to some kids. I also think some kids are just weird little goths about death. My almost 8-year-old, after she had sort of internalized the concept of death, informed me that after I died, she would take my skeleton to the passport office every 10 years. So I would continue to have a passport even after I was dead. So, you know, you just never know how kids are going to bounce on these things. I guess I will have a passport. I don't know about coins to pay the ferryman. But some kids need sensitive movies about death, and some kids are special, like mine is. Love you, kiddo.
All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Sheep Detectives? Alyssa?
Thumbs up. Excited to stream it at home with my kids at some point.
Thumbs up. It's one of the better movies I've seen this year. Along with Project Hail Mary, which is directed by Phil Lord Miller, they executive produced this. And you really, I mean, this is not their movie, but you can see their fingerprints on this, both in the style of humor and in just the kind of clever excellence of the animation and the way the animation is used to be both funny and profound.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's about right.
And the Christian themes in both films, right? Like the kind of quite there,
yes.
But also you don't have to notice them if you don't want to, but like this is a weird B-side to Project Hail Mary is what I'm saying.
Well, between this, between these two movies and then Christopher McQuarrie's last two with Tom Cruise, we've got a little whole Christian film colony out this sotto voce. Anyway, thumbs up. It's a nice movie. I don't think it's great. It's probably not going to make my top 10 or anything, but it's a very nice, very fun little movie. And it's a good time at the theaters. I hope people check it out. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday. Hopefully.